from Cabernet to Monet, they're here to slay the art history babes.
Art History Babe Briefs.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Corey.
I'm Natalie.
I'm Jen, and we are the Art History Babes.
We have a baby episode for you today. For those of you who don't know, baby episodes are short, little, kind of to the point episodes that don't have any expletives. So you can use them in school.
And around the children.
Around the kiddos. Today, we're talking about Birth of Venus.
Which just, it does have some sexual...
sexual content.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we'll just take it easy with that, but we will talk about it. Yeah. Just in a very...
I just realized I said you can play it in front of your kids, so I should probably tell people that is coming.
Yeah, and then this is now going to speak to the level of your parenting. How much do you talk to your kids about this stuff? We don't know. So turn back now.
Or, if, like, do you want them to learn about sex through the Art History Babes?
We'll do it.
We'll do it.
You know?
We'll do a hot takes sex ed episode.
Oh, man.
When mommies and daddies love each other very much.
It'll be great. But yeah, this painting's sexy. It's a sexy painting.
Yeah. It's one of those that most people know about. So we might as well...
Or have seen, at least.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a recognizable image, for sure.
Should we start with some facts?
Some facts. Here we go on the facts. Sandro Botticelli, born in 1445, was an Italian Renaissance painter. He belonged to the Florentine school, training in the workshop Fra Filippo Lippi, and eventually working under the patronage of Lorenzo de' Medici. He lived his entire life in the same neighborhood in Florence, which is, I just think, is cute.
That is really cute.
He just liked his home. Wow. And that's nice.
Dangerous nowadays, but at the time, I'm sure it was adorable.
Yeah. He is known for painting mainly portraits and religious subjects. However, his mythological subjects, although few in number, are some of his most famous works. The Birth of Venus is often discussed with Botticelli's other large-scale mythological work, Primavera. Although they are not a pair, the paintings are significant because depictions of subjects from classical mythology on a very large scale were virtually unprecedented in Western art since classical antiquity. The size and prominence of a nude female figure in The Birth of Venus was also uncommon in the early Renaissance. We'll talk about that a little bit more a little later on. The work was commissioned for the home of Lorenzo di Pier Francesco de' Medici.
Nice. Wow. Good job.
Thank you. And was meant to hang above a marital bed.
Beautiful.
Right? That seems like a nice spot.
That's where I would want it.
Right?
So big, though. How big was the bed?
Hopefully very large.
Yeah, humongous.
I really like to imagine a just huge, luscious bed with Birth of Venus hanging above it.
And if you're a Medici, you better have the most luscious bed.
Right?
I mean, they were wealthy.
Do you think they called it like a Florentine king? Instead of a California king?
Wow. Ooh.
Probably.
Probably. They Probably. Should.
New goals. Get a Florentine king size bed.
With a Botticelli over the top.
Dang.
There we go. I'm going to start visualizing that, manifest that into my life.
I know. I'm seeing it right now.
In the early Renaissance, painting on canvas wasn't really a thing. They were pretty much all about painting on panels. However, wood panel was susceptible to warp due to humidity, and canvas started to become a more commonly used and often looked down upon medium. Birth of Venus is said to be the first work of its size painted on canvas in Tuscany.
So let's take a closer look. I think we didn't quite throw out a date. We have a date here. Circa 1484 to around 1486 is when we're dating this work. So in the middle, in the center, we are presented with the newly born goddess Venus, and she is nude and standing in a giant scallop shell. On the left, she is flanked by the wind god Zephyr, who blows at her, and the wind is shown by the lines that are radiating from his mouth. So he's in the air, and he also is carrying a young female who is also blowing, but less forcefully. They both have wings. So Vasari, who was a writer of art history, one of the earliest art historians, we could probably say.
He was like the the OG
art historian. Vasari was probably correct when he identified her as Aura, the personification of a light breeze, which I think is very sweet.
It's calming.
Yeah. So in their joint effort, they're blowing Venus towards the shore. So what's the old story? She was...
We'll get there.
Okay, we'll get there. There's a story.
There is a story, you guys.
So in their joint efforts, they are blowing Venus towards the shore. On the right is a female figure who appears to be floating slightly above the ground, and she's holding out a rich cloak to dress Venus when she reaches the shore. She's one of the three Ore, or Hours. These are Greek minor goddesses of the seasons and of other divisions of time. And also, they are attendants of Venus. The floral decoration of her dress suggests that she is the Hora of spring. So the subject is not strictly the birth of Venus. It's a title only given to the painting in the 19th century, though this was given as the subject by Vasari. But the next scene in her story, where she arrives on land blown by the wind, seems to be what we're actually seeing. The land probably represents either Cythera or Cyprus, both Mediterranean islands regarded by the Greeks as territories of Venus.
Do you remember those great old Hollywood biographies like Van Gogh in Lust for Life or Michelangelo in The Agony and the Ecstasy? Now imagine the epic story of the baddest bad boy of the Baroque, Caravaggio. He was the centerpiece of one of our earliest episodes, and now Ken Mora is creating a new graphic novel that tells the tale of Caravaggio, how his art revived the dying church, how his ambition exposed his secret lover, and how his sword sealed their tragic fate. Now at Kickstarter.com, you can help make this graphic novel a reality. Caravaggio, A Light Before the Darkness. Head over to Kickstarter.com, search for Caravaggio, or we will have a link in our show notes where you can support Caravaggio, A Light Before the Darkness.
So the story, let's get to it.
The mythology.
In mythology, Venus, or Aphrodite to the Greeks, Venus to the Romans, was born on the island of Paphos. As it goes, Uranus and Gaia had a son named Cronos, or Cronus, or Cronos. I'm going to say Cronos. Uranus and Gaia got into a heated debate, and Gaia gave Cronos a sickle, a la the Grim Reaper, just to give you a visual, with which to attack his father. Cronos castrated Uranus and threw his genitalia into the sea.
Brutal.
Yeah, right?
It's pretty rough.
Yeah, talk about Oedipus complex. According to mythology, the testicles and the sea foam mix together to produce the goddess of love and beauty, who emerges from the foam as a fully formed woman. In reference to Botticelli's depiction of the scene, this has led some to believe that the seashell that Venus is riding to shore upon represents a vagina.
Ah.
Yes.
Yes. Because she is being birthed from it.
Mm-hmm. And
get it?
Yeah.
Birth of Venus. She is being birthed.
Yes.
From this symbol.
But wow. While that was a visual choice of Botticelli, it is worth mentioning that Venus was not conceived naturally by a man and a woman, but by a man and nature. And we should probably talk about that a little. It parallels the same. Because in the same way,
there's a meowing cat. Hi, kitten.
Wanting attention real bad.
I love you.
Aw, is this Wheezy?
Yeah.
It's a fat kitten.
She's large.
Insane. Always.
Okay.
She's my favorite shape.
She's an absolute unit.
Yeah, she's her own shape. She really is an absolute unit.
I'm in awe at the size of her.
Oh, man.
She might just, you know, be done. I don't know.
She's never done.
Let's just keep going and see what she decides.
If you want to see what she looks like, make sure to watch this episode on our YouTube channel. We'll throw in some footage of Wheezy for you.
I'm sure she'll work it for the camera.
Yeah. So in the same way that Jesus Christ was conceived purely and without the need for heterosexual sex, which if you're going to get into like religion and stuff, is impure. So
it's a no-no.
It's just no good.
It's sticky. It's a sticky topic. So the major difference, though, between the birth of Venus and the birth of Christ is that a human man was not needed for the conception of Christ, and a human female was not needed for the conception or creation of Venus, because at least Mary brought Christ to birth. You know what I mean? She carried him.
Right.
Whereas there's no woman involved at all in the creation of Venus. It's man and nature, and then produces the god of love. So what does it mean if the ultimate symbol of kind of sex, love, fertility is made sans woman?
Oh my God, I have some thoughts.
I do too, because I feel like also, you know, nature is often considered like a divine feminine force. Mm-hmm. You know, nature and the feminine are related a lot throughout history. Mm-hmm. So I think it could be looked at as just like a bigger representation of woman, but it could also be looked at through the lens of the patriarchy,
which is the lens that it was invented in. Yeah. So we should probably,
I think it could be a little bit of both, depending, because I think that story has some interesting layers, you know. Yeah. What I mean,
like, I want to think of it in the first way that you mentioned, as nature being the divine feminine, but I'm also highly just prone to believe that this idea of like removing sexuality from women and making it a male created thing,
yes,
is just like,
it's the ultimate power move that they can pull.
That's just patriarchy 101.
I agree 100%, and I think you're right, but I do like that. I think this image can be looked at in a in a more empowering way if you want to like examine it that way. But I agree, in the context of just the myth and the like what I know about Greek mythology and how they weren't big fans of women, like it does sound very patriarchal.
Yeah, and we should specify that when we're talking about the misogynist bend to this story, we're talking about the mythology, not Botticelli necessarily. Yeah. We don't know what his thoughts were, and he didn't invent the story. He's just representing it. Mm-hmm. And there's claims that he was using more contemporary poem as his inspiration for the visuals versus the original mythology.
And that, I think, is just a good thing to remember about ancient mythology in general, is like there are a lot of different ways to look at a lot of these stories. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, were examined through various lenses throughout the entire course of human history and have taken on new meanings. So like, yeah, you definitely can't say that this is Botticelli's viewpoint, but there's definitely a statement being made with that myth. Like, yes. I think that is fair to say.
Yeah.
Oh, the wasp is back.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
So many interruptions.
There's a wasp.
So we're attempting to...
Should we take our break now instead?
Yeah, we're going to take a break.
We're going to take our break a little early. We're going to take a quick break and deal with this. Yeah. All right, bye.
Bye. We have returned. We took care of the situation.
We hope. Yeah, we didn't see the body, but we did, you know, spray ourselves with a cloud of Raid. So.
We're just sitting in a cloud of chemicals.
It's fine.
It's fine.
We're fine.
Anyways, back to Birth of Venus. So the work was kind of like controversial back in Renaissance times. When it was first painted, it was controversial, not because it was a naked lady, but because it was a naked lady in a non-Christian context. So in the Western art of the Middle Ages and early Renaissance, figures were only painted in the nude to promote a Christian teaching of some sort. For example, scenes of Adam and Eve's impure naked bodies being dispelled from the Garden of Eden because of all of their impurity. Not only was the story in Birth of Venus from a classical non-Christian mythology, but this is an image that kind of seems to like celebrate or idealize nudity in some sense. And people didn't really know what to do with that.
Right. This idea of nudity and appreciation for the female body outside of any sort of...
I think from what I've heard that the loophole to this problem of not being able to show nude women was kind of using classical mythology your, you know, excuse, rationale, whatever you want to call it.
That makes sense.
But men could have these paintings in their studies a lot of times. So this one we're talking about was made for a bedroom. But for a lot of the other paintings of nude women, especially those representing classical mythology, they were for men's studies because they are supposed to symbolize like wisdom or beauty or the higher pursuits.
Of course. the higher pursuits.
Ah, yes.
If you study the high pursuits, you get to gaze upon nude women.
Yeah.
So we're not exactly sure what Botticelli's ideas of women or sexuality were, but we do know that later on in life, his religious views took a sharp turn. So in the last years of his life, his work became overtly religious and he became a follower of a fanatical Christian preacher. Some have suggested that he rejected his early works, such as The Birth of Venus. There's even claims that Botticelli threw some of his works into a bonfire of the vanities.
The bonfire of the vanities.
Bonfire of the vanities.
So for those of you who don't know, the bonfire of the vanities was a mass burning of objects such as art, jewelry, mirrors, vanities, if you will. And this was all instigated by the Dominican friar. Let me see about this pronunciation. Girolamo Savonarola.
Savonarola is how you say his last name. I don't remember how to say his first name.
Girolamo.
I really don't remember his first name at all.
Girolamo Savonarola
is how you say
it. There we go.
And this all went down on February 7th, 1497. And so the idea was that these objects promoted sin and took glory away from God. Somehow, despite the controversy surrounding it, Birth of Venus was spared. Wow.
Wow. Didn't get burnt up with all the rest of the vanities.
For real.
It was too big. It would have been such a hassle.
Yeah. You know, it would have been a whole thing. It really would have.
I mean, I'm sure that Medici owning it had nothing to do with it.
Probably not.
So after his death, Botticelli's paintings kind of fell out of favor for a while until the 19th century. And even then, Primavera was his best known work. Birth of Venus was not nearly as popular. Interestingly, The Birth of Venus became well known due to a series of traveling exhibitions to celebrate the old Italian masters, which was organized by none other than Mussolini.
That's peculiar.
Because, you know, Mussolini's got to come into the story somehow.
Somehow. I was just waiting for you to mention Mussolini.
Everyone was. You can all breathe now. The exhibitions were planned for political gain, but this work by Botticelli was selected for more practical purposes. So, like Corey had mentioned earlier, it was painted on canvas, unlike Primavera, which was painted on wood. And canvas is a lot easier to transport without fear of serious damage like warping or cracking the wood. The painting was extremely well received in London, Paris, and at the 1935 San Francisco's World Fair. And then 5 years later, it brought a whopping 290,000 people to New York's MoMA in a 74-day period.
Wow.
All right. Birth of Venus. Have you all seen it?
Yes.
Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it in person.
So it's at the Uffizi, and it is very stunning to see in person. Definitely should if you get the opportunity.
The scale is just...
Yeah. It's huge. And
did we talk about 6 by 9 feet? I don't know if we ever actually mentioned the exact...
It's a big painting.
Yeah, 6 feet by 9 feet, guys.
So you're kind of immersed into this image. But what was particularly interesting to me, so when visiting the Uffizi in Florence, I noticed that the institution provides a tactile version of the painting for visitors with impaired vision. And this, I thought that was just super cool when I saw it. I was like, that's amazing. And then caused me to look into it a little bit more. And apparently the Uffizi offers an entire Uffizi by touch tour that includes a map and descriptions of many works in Braille. And the tour includes several statues, many of which belonged to the Medici collection. And visitors are given special gloves, and they are actually allowed to touch the actual sculptures, not reproductions.
That is so cool.
Right? And so they get to actually have this very like immersive experience with the artwork. And then The Birth of Venus is basically the experience of The Birth of Venus on this tour is a smaller relief style sculpture of the painting that is located in front of where the painting hangs. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's kind of creating a relief experience of the painting. So all around, just a cool thing.
Yeah. That is so awesome. I know. I love that.
Right?
The Uffizi.
I would have never even thought about that.
Right?
Yeah. The Uffizi is just a great museum in general. And I love that this painting stayed in Florence.
Yeah. I didn't even think about that. Yeah. just like Botticelli.
Aww. Just like. Aww. It's Papa.
It's how old Bots would have liked it. Papa Bots.
Papa Butts. that's what we call him.
Yeah. In our circle, that's what we're allowed to call him that.
Pop Butt.
Old Daddy Butts. Oh man. All right. So let's do just a little visual analysis. Let's look at the painting and think about some things,
okay,
you guys, because that's what all good art historians do, right?
I love it.
So we're looking at it. I think the first thing that we can discuss a little bit, and this is an issue that pops into a lot of Venus images, is kind of the impossibility of the pose. She would fall over. Like, she would straight fall over.
Right. Like, no one's body can actually stand this way.
I feel like it's an attempt at a very, like, feminine... Nat is trying to do it right now.
But your foot would have to be... Yeah, I don't know, girl. Yeah. It's a lot.
And, because I feel like if you look at the feet, it looks as though her weight is on this foot, but the way her upper body is, it's not pushing that way, you know what I mean? So I feel like the weight is not...
Right. And here's the thing about these works, and we see it a lot later in, like, romantic sort of paintings, like the Grand Odalisque.
Mm-hmm.
You know how her body doesn't make any sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This sort of notion of a feminine body that couldn't really exist in real life, no one is appreciating these forms for, like, would she actually be able to stand? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like an awkward kind of trying to be contrapposto.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
We're not quite there yet.
I feel like it's a feminized ideal attempt at a contrapposto.
Yeah. And I think this is one of those situations where not necessarily having access to female models, live models, they're working from multiple sources that are mm-hmm. not exact references, male bodies a lot of times, and then kind of trying to add boobs later curves,
right.
Which was totally a thing.
Well, I think that they get a little bit better at this into, like, high Renaissance.
But even, like, Leonardo da Vinci has a lot where if you look, it's like a jacked man and then just little boobs, like it in
well,
and not
okay.
trying to, like, act like, you know, obviously women come in all shapes and sizes, but to the point that you are like he painted a man.
I think that we can say with a level of certainty that those were men.
Yes, exactly. They were. Yeah, not
yeah.
trying to, like,
right.
talk about women's bodies that way. Like, it straight up was a male model
right.
that he later tried to convert.
I don't know if Da Vinci ever saw a nude woman.
I don't know that there's any evidence he ever did. I'm serious.
I really
straight up had an
did.
Art history professor who made it seem that he never would have. And that this was kind of common.
Interesting. That's very interesting.
Ah, yes.
Ah, yes, ah, yes.
What else do we have here?
So the detailing, I think, the decorative detailing elements of this painting is just widely talked about and is also, I think, what kind of sets it apart, what makes it even more beautiful, has kind of helped to make it the masterpiece that it is. You have the fabrics, which have these, like, beautiful decorative patterns on the fabrics, which is very interesting.
Billowing. There's a lot of billowing.
There is a lot of billowing happening. You also have, like, the gold detailing in her, like, in her hair and in the shell.
Mm-hmm.
Which is just, like, a very, I think, striking detail.
Yeah.
Well, and he's almost famous for this hair color, right? This, like, it's like a Botticelli red.
Yeah,
like this,
it's a reddish, blondish, like...
This copper-headed...
It's beautiful hair
color. I mean, look, all the women have it. He kind of coined it.
Wow, idea, art history babes hair dye line. Botticelli red.
Oh, there it is.
Ooh, there's probably so many more good ones.
Oh yeah.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. What I really love about this painting, so this is so early Renaissance to me. This is such a quintessential work because I really feel like this whole idea of space isn't mm-hmm. really fleshed out yet.
Yeah.
So there's very shallow space in this work, and you can tell they're kind of trying to have a level of space. You see like the very thin strip of land that's supposed to be very far away behind the body of Venus. However, you know, we're not seeing any kind of atmospheric perspective at mm-hmm. this point. Although it did exist, Botticelli just wasn't utilizing it.
Yeah, he's almost like where Renaissance naturalism and mannerism kind of meet.
Yeah.
Where he's doing a little bit of both. He's trying to be natural at points. Mm-hmm. And I think overall it reads as a little bit more naturalism or...
Right.
Whatever you would like to call it. But it definitely has those mannerist qualities of like the elongated, going back to the bodies, like the kind of elongated arms and legs and mm-hmm. like, where's that bone? And
right. I also really like this sort of scalloped wave pattern. Like
waves
would
at that.
Never look like that. You know, like you get the suggestion of wave.
There are waves happening.
The idea of waves.
Yeah.
So that's, I like that a lot. And yeah, I feel like Nat really hit it on the head, sort of where mannerism and realism meet.
Yeah, especially now I'm like looking at her neck and like the way that her neck is kind
right.
of elongated.
Like, what's up with that neck,
yeah,
baby girl?
And at an interesting angle, like that's mannerism mm-hmm. beginning. Mm-hmm.
Definitely, mm-hmm. I think, yeah. Wow! So this painting is often considered a pinnacle of beauty. It is often used as a beauty standard to which other objects of beauty from various time periods have been compared. It has also widely been subverted as a means of commentary on beauty standards. Lots of heavy things there. So basically, like, why do we love it? Why do we love this painting so much? And in what ways do you guys consider this painting to be representative of beauty?
Just kind of cutting back to what we were just talking about, like the elongated features and that kind of thing is already where my eyes are starting to like roll to the back of my head about why we would consider that to be an ideal of beauty nowadays. Is like, we are much in the era of it's been popular for a while, so I'm not trying to put it all on the 21st century by any means, but I think the reason it's still in favor is we're all about almost this unattainable beauty that is now attainable via things like plastic surgery and all of that.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Like, corsets are back. That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, I think when it comes to exactly like the feminine image, I think they're really complicated. Yeah, the whole idealized woman beauty standards thing. I don't know, at this point it's like, are we done with this yet, you know?
I think we're getting there.
However, I do want to kind of mention, going back to what I was saying before, I do think there are things about this painting that are a little bit more of like an objective beauty thing. Like I was saying, like the decorative patterning and stuff. They're like, humans are inherently attracted to patterning. That's why decorative patterns are just, they're naturally appealing to the human mind, you know? So I think there are elements, this painting, that are in some way representative of what humans find beautiful. But then I think when you're thinking more in terms of the body figures and the human beings being represented, I think that is more of this like, idealized creation of beauty that we've created. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. And it fits because she's being created in this scene. Like, and she's the goddess of beauty. So, I mean, just in the storyline and the title and everything, we just already are thinking of the epitome of quote unquote beauty.
Yeah.
I mean, and she is beautiful. I mean, if we break it down, you know, if let's just say we're talking from a Western point of view in considering what's traditionally beautiful, from what I can tell, a symmetrical face, long flowing hair. There's a lot of flowing in the wind.
Many flowing
There's
elements.
Flowing, you know.
This color used to be all the rage back when they would like try and lighten their hair with
I love
assorted
it.
Chemicals.
It's such a good color.
Like, we don't do that now. I'm talking about it back like this is such an ancient practice.
Back when they used to do that.
You know, I mean, there's evidence of like a muscularness, but it's very much concealed by a lot of soft mm-hmm. angles. It's very soft. She's so soft, in fact, that her shoulders.
How soft is she?
Her shoulders make no sense anatomically. Yeah. What is going on with this arm?
It has to follow the wave of her hair, apparently.
Yeah, exactly. The arm, there's no real bones in that arm. And so these things to us sound so ridiculous, but if we are thinking of what's considered beautiful in a Western male gaze dominated sort of discourse of beauty, then she's the epitome.
I also think there's something to just the way the mind perceives like flowing in smooth lines as opposed to, because like, yeah, this arm makes no sense, but it's also just following like a curve. Mm-hmm. And so she doesn't look like, when you look at it and think about it logically, all of a sudden it looks very weird. But right. I think on first glance, you just see a smooth line. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And, you know, what I love about this is I'm thinking like 400 years later when Manet came out with Olympia mm-hmm. and everyone was losing their minds because you were seeing an anatomically sound structure of a woman's body.
And there was a sharpness to her.
And she was sharp and people were very upset. So
and they could recognize who she was.
Yeah,
and they knew her class and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a lot. So, you know, we're talking, this is a safe woman. She's got no bones.
Well, she's not real.
She's not real. I mean, not only is she Venus, but I mean, who is she really? I mean, she could be anybody. These are pretty standard, generic features of a pretty face.
She's just something for you to project your absolutely idealized visions.
And for many, that is really the epitome of beauty. So for the time, for the purpose, I think that this is an excellent work of art because it's doing exactly what it's supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I think within the context, especially at a time where, you're just trying to achieve beauty with art a lot of the time like that. I do think that he was, doing what he was supposed to do. But I do think this work continues to be interesting because of everything that's come from it. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we can subvert this image and we can think about this image in different ways.
Yeah, definitely. And it has been, as we saw at the Louvre, even like it's everywhere and they don't even have it. Or was that Primavera?
I think that the Louvre has Primavera does the Uffizi have both?
It might.
Mystery.
I don't know. I don't know where the Primavera is.
We don't know right at this moment, but we do know that the Birth of Venus exists at the Uffizi Gallery in Florence. And if you ever have a chance,
check it out, man.
Go see it. I mean,
go see her and her boneless existence.
So Primavera is also at the Uffizi. But I swear to you that the Louvre uses the image of the Birth of Venus as marketing. I think it's all over the Louvre. I have such a distinct memory.
I feel like Birth of Venus is another one of those big images similar to the Mona Lisa that just gets thrown on everything to represent art, to be like, it's art.
Yeah.
Birth of Venus, it's art. You know? So I think that image does get used all over the place. But yeah. Birth of Venus. It's a painting.
Check it out.
It's
a big painting. It's a beautiful painting.
It's an interesting painting.
Yeah. There's a lot to talk about.
Yeah. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you want to see our faces while we talked about all this and look at some images of the stuff we talked about, head over to our YouTube channel where this episode will be posted. And, you know, check out our other stuff. Email us. Follow us on social media. All the things, y'all.
I forgot we were
awesome
recording this.
Yeah,
like on
right there.
I forgot.
Hello.
Hi. Okay. Check us all out. Follow us on everything. And we love you.
Bye.
Bye.
From Cabernet to Monet, they're here to slay the art history babes.
Of Fra Philippe. Filippo? Yes.
Filippo.
The Art History Babes podcast is made possible by support from our lovely listeners via Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/arthistorybabes to help keep the Art History Babes going and for access to bonus content.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.